I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before coming onto the podcast, I'd love it if you could hit subscribe, comment, give us a review, send it to your mates. If you are into this podcast, it means the world to me and it means that we can keep going. So, podcast time. I'm going to absolutely butcher Anastasia's name because I can't speak Russian, but Anastasia Muravieva. She is the head of marketing at The Sound in LA, the Spotlight in LA, and the Framework Events Company. I started working with her when I recently played Sound in LA last year, I believe. I love how she works, and I really wanted to get some people in the behind the scenes in the industry to talk about how they work and kind of, there's so many people that work behind the scenes in this industry that make all the cogs work and make us have amazing shows that we all go to and party at and DJ at and kind of help build the community. She's amazing at her job, and I just wanted to get her on and have a conversation. So without further ado, Anastasia. And we are live. I just realized I didn't move my suitcase, so you can probably see my massive suitcase in
honestly
the back.
It's a metaphor for the life we chose to live.
Anastasia, how are you?
I'm doing okay, how are you?
Yeah, good. This is sounds may sound really rude, but how the hell do I pronounce your last name?
I can hardly say it myself. Muravieva.
What the fuck? Say that again.
Muravieva.
Okay, that's good to know.
Some people say it sounds like ravioli. I say it however it feels right.
Okay, amazing. Where's it from?
Russia. I was born and raised in Russia. We came here as refugees in 2000.
Oh, wow.
So my name, both first and last name, were spelled phonetically because my parents were still learning how to speak English. Which is why I don't even think I can say it right because of my heavy American accent when speaking Russian.
Can you speak Russian?
Conversationally, not fluently. I took a Russian course in college to try to get my Russian a little bit better.
Yeah.
My grandmothers only speak Russian. My parents speak to me in English because they're always practicing. So I kind of lost it throughout the years. But if I ever needed to go to Russia for whatever reason, which I don't see in the foreseeable future ever happening,
yeah,
I feel like I could get by.
Can you remember moving to America or were you too young?
I kind of remember. I have like bits and pieces of it. I have these like very distinct memories of what my apartment in Russia looked like, but growing up, most of it is a blur. It was a really hard time for my family.
Yeah.
Obviously, they dropped everything and had to start a new life in a country that's like not familiar to them.
Mm.
And they always say that like immigrant burden is just like so heavy with first generation children that I kind of like carried that throughout my life, and I don't want to say like blocked out most of my childhood, yeah. but had to get through so much that, you know, most of it is just kind of like unbeknownst to me in my subconscious.
No, 100%. It's really interesting because you don't really often get it in the UK so much. But the immigrant, well, you obviously get a lot of immigrants in the UK, but the kind of the immigrant culture in America is way more kind of apparent in comparison to growing up in the UK for me. And like, I've got so many friends that are like first generation immigrants to in America, but there's also a level of like obscene amounts of hustle that comes from first generation immigrants. What's that about?
I think when you really understand how much your family sacrificed to give you a better life,
yeah.
you know, of anywhere that anyone can move, even in the early 2000s, like it was the American dream.
Yeah.
And coming to a country where you're learning how to assimilate to the culture and learning the language, and your skills may not necessarily translate because of the language barriers. So whereas you may have been an engineer in Russia, you can't necessarily do the same because of the language barrier here. And you think about that as, you know, a first generation child of what they gave up for you to have a better life. It's almost like you don't want to fail your parents in a way, which is funny because I chose music and that's a whole nother story of all the sacrifices I made and the like the horror on my parents' face when I gave up so much to pursue this career. Yeah. It very much is you don't want to disappoint them because they gave so much for you to be here and they gave you everything they possibly could to set you up for success. That failure just isn't an option, especially when you're an only child.
Can't fall back on your brother or sister. I feel that because
nope, it's just me.
It was one of my friends, her parents, or she's from Albania and like first generation Albania and Albanian immigrants, and it's exactly the same. I've had the conversation with her multiple times. She's like an extremely intelligent person and went through like college to like do her like dentistry, everything like that, like medical, all of that, and then like moved to become like a psychiatrist, and then was like, I've just always wanted to work in music, and now works at Live Nation. And like the like it's been really interesting to see the like dynamics of how she copes with certain things, because like it's very, I think the American dream is like become a doctor, become an architect, become a nurse, become something that's just like, we moved here for you to have a better life, so go do it. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of the older generations, our parents' ages, music was never a career. It was like the pipe dream, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have roots in the entertainment industry. My grandfather was like the Leonardo DiCaprio of Soviet Russia.
No way.
Supposedly. I actually just saw photos from films for the first time when I went home back last year.
Yeah.
And least to say it was mind blowing. But so it wasn't so much that like music was this thing that they pushed back against. I think there's just this level of concern and care because it is such a risky industry to pursue, and the last thing they want to see is you carry on, you know, the financial burden or the struggle that they had to go through. It's not to say that they weren't supportive. I mean, over time they definitely got on board, especially as they kind of saw it more as a stable career. Yeah. As opposed to, oh, you're just doing this because you want to party all the time, or you're just doing this because, you know, you want to be in it or in the scene. Now that they've kind of been able to conceptualize what it is that we really do, they've been far more understanding of the circumstances per se. But there's something to be said for taking a risk, right? Especially when they take a risk to move here. Yeah. Of all places, they understand that all good things in life come with risk and like jumping into things headfirst and working your ass off. And I'm a workaholic by nature. So I think over time they just understood that failure in any aspect of the word is just not an option for me. Yeah. And I was going to do whatever it took to, you know, achieve what I saw for myself when I knew the other options just weren't the right fit.
No, I get that. What were the other options?
Well, fun fact, I was a semi-professional fencer.
No way.
Yeah. So when we moved over, my mom went to law school to study immigration law. She did 2 years of English. And then my dad became a fencing coach because he was a fencer. So yeah, that was the most accessible job to him and able to translate his skills from Russia to the United States. So I consequently started fencing too, and wasn't that bad at it. Surprisingly, I was ranked like 40th in the world at some point, and I couldn't compete directly for the United States, as like a representative for the country, until I was like 16, because I didn't get my citizenship until I was 16. And they had just changed the bylaws that you had to be a citizen to represent the United States, yeah, as opposed to just having a green card. So for a really long time, that was my entire life. I was training after school, 8 hours a day. I was state champion. I was getting recruited to all the best schools. I was supposed to go to Cornell. I had verbally committed to them. And that was kind of like my path, was like, go to an Ivy League, get a good education. I was thinking of psychology or something, you know, a little bit more, you know, secure. Yeah. And the one thing that I noticed in the fencing community was that if you dedicate your whole life growing up to fencing, a lot of, you know, other fencers would just continue pursuing fencing, whether as coaches or club owners, yeah, or referees. And I quite frankly just didn't see that for myself. I loved it. I don't want to say I had a great time. It was a really difficult, competitive, you know, sport. My dad was my coach. That was just a whole nother added layer to it. Whole nother dynamic, but it taught me a lot of discipline. So when I realized that that wasn't my path, that's kind of when I had to call Cornell up on the phone and be like, listen, thank you so much for the opportunity. I think I'm going to pursue nightlife instead, because right around the time that I was interviewing for all of these schools was right when I discovered like dance music, yeah, and nightlife. I was living in New Jersey. I was right outside of, you know, the greatest nightclubs in the world at the time. Pasha, Webster Hall was like in its prime. It was a couple of years before the Brooklyn Mirage came to be. Output was open. Verboten was, yeah, open. And I was using my friend's fake ID to get into all of these places. And I was so in love with what they were creating that I knew instantaneously there was no other option for me than just to stay in the city and figure out, how do I make a stable life for myself here? So I had to go to my parents. I had to say, listen, I'm not going to go to Cornell. I'm going to stay in the city and pursue a career in nightlife instead. And they say, what do you mean? What is a career in nightlife? What does that look like? What school are you going to go to? Columbia didn't want me. So they were like, there's no other schools in New York. Yeah. I'm like, well, there's NYU. They had no idea what NYU was. They were like, what is this tier 3 bottom barrel school that we've never heard of? I'm like, I promise you, it's a good school. So I ended up going to NYU and just like, sticking in and going into all of the, you know, not necessarily working, but I guess you could consider my roots in nightlife very bottle rat-ish, yeah, to be fully transparent with you. There's no nepotism in my life. I had no foot in the door. I didn't understand how the industry worked. I didn't understand what the differences of the 3 kinds of promoters are, that there's a club promoter, a table promoter, a promoter that just brings people, a promoter that produces, yeah, events. I had no idea. And I would look at all of these people being like, what do you do? Like, how did you get here? I want to be there too. So I knew that if I stayed in New York City with the small bearings that I had, yeah, my loose connections, that maybe, just maybe, with my work ethic, something could come to be. Mm. Unfortunately, it did. And fortunately, there's some longevity to it.
Fortunately or unfortunately?
You know, I like to say fortunately, because there's definitely worse jobs that we can have.
True,
you know?
True.
I think I forget it sometimes, but...
Is there something about... Actually, it's funny that you talk about fencing. Do you know Monica Xammert?
I do, actually. Loose connection. We were familiar with each other probably like 4 or 5 years ago. But yes, I'm very familiar.
She's been on the podcast as well. She came on the podcast in the early days.
I saw that. Yeah. I thought I recognized her name.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny how small the world is. So there's also an app called Radiate. It's owned by Phil Butler.
What's Radiate?
Radiate is a, it's not Tinder for festivals is their slogan. They put up festivals on their app and it's a way of connecting with other people going to the same festivals and events. It was really revolutionary for its time. And the owner and creator of Radiate and the co-founder, Michael Tom, I have known since I was like 8 years old. They're like 10 years older than me, maybe 15. But they used to referee me when I was like 8 years old competing. And now they're like partnering with all the big festivals and all the big names and becoming the official app. Now I see them all the time. And I think about how small of a world it is for us to just kind of end up on the same path.
Yeah.
But it's to say that you never know who you're going to meet down the line, and always, you know, keep your friends close and treat people with kindness, because you never know who you're going to run back into.
100%. And on the way up, when you're on the way up, there's going to be a way down at some point. So you got to look after everybody.
Yeah.
I want to.
Must come down.
Yeah, 100%. I want to, first of all, talk about what you do. I'd love you to explain what you do and kind of how we know each other. And then we can kind of get more into the detail of that.
For sure. So I'm the marketing director for an event production company called Framework. Underneath the Framework umbrella is Sound Nightclub, and we just opened a new nightclub called The Spotlight. We do a whole slew of incredible things under the Framework portfolio. We, you know, predominantly focus on offsite, large scale productions. We have the Yuma stage at Coachella, which I'm not involved in. It's the talent department, and it's absolutely incredible what they do in partnership with Golden Voice. We have the Framework in the Desert series, which is our after parties after the festival, which we bring over the Yuma headliners to a really insane airport hangar and throw an after this there. We do the offsites in LA. Like last year, we shut down Hollywood Boulevard for the first time with Chris Lake and Fisher, which was monumental to say the least. We also hosted Afterlife in partnership with Golden Voice. Solomon at Exposition Park, Dom Dalla at Jin Ling Wei. So we do really unique experiences at venues that try to, you know, recreate what a venue really is. Hot Since 82 at Union Station is another really great example of that. And then you and I met because you headlined Sound with us.
Yep.
Sound is our brick and mortar location. It's been around for 10 years. It's, I believe, the longest independently operated venue in the country, if not the world.
Oh, wow.
That specifically focuses on house music. So it's a very special place where you see a lot of underplays and a lot of development of talent. And the Spotlight is new. It just opened last month. It's our first thing where we're trying to expand our offerings and go outside of just the electronic dance music realm, where we are taking a something for everyone approach, looking into jazz bookings on top of underplays, on top of label release parties for all genres. So that's something that's new for us that we're kind of learning as we go. But
yeah,
that's
the Spotlight
a really
looks,
exciting addition.
The Spotlight looks bougie as fuck.
It's so great.
It looks amazing.
It's so much fun. It's definitely, it's in Hollywood proper. It's like a couple blocks away from the Capitol Records building.
Yeah.
It's an homage to like old Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's a really, really beautiful venue. The sound system is amazing. In the first week, we had so many people in the room that we could have only ever dreamed of. It's almost, it feels like it'll have a lore to it in years down the line. So we're kind of excited to see where it goes. You open a room with a vision in mind of what it can be, but you know, the neighborhood and the environment kind of helps it take its course as well. So we're excited to see how everything is going to move along and where it goes.
It's also really interesting because it's not often that we see new venues open, especially in the States. And I think it's just really interesting when a new venue, even if it's not in the electronic world specifically, it's really interesting to see how club owners, promoters, teams like yourselves kind of have an approach to opening new venues, because it really doesn't happen ever.
Yeah, I mean, Spotlight is a really small room. It's 250 to 350 if you open the Garden. And I think there's this call right now for intimate spaces. Yeah. Obviously, the framework, portfolio, everything that we do is so grand and at such a large scale. And then sound is that perfect mid-size room where it's like 600 after guest list and tickets. Spotlight kind of fits that bill where you can really be a little more experimental with what you do there and kind of test the waters for, you know, new artists that are coming to be, whether, like I said, whether it's electronic or non-electronic, understanding, you know, how they play in a small, very low stakes room. There's no tickets, it's guest list or, you know, doorman's discretion only. So we're not necessarily relying on ticket sales to speak to, you know, the power or the strength of an artist that's playing, which allows us to do experimental things. Like this Thursday, we're doing Miguel and Tons, who are space residents. And then last week we had Peace Control, which are, they're so new on the market. They have one song, Kind Music has been playing it, but you know, they have 5,000 monthly listeners on Spotify, which is not something that could necessarily fit for sound particularly, but could work really well for a room like Spotlight and really give these artists kind of a foot in the door and kind of showcase, you know, who they are, what they do to a new market in a very low stakes scenario.
I think I hoot and holler on about this for people must be bored about it on this podcast because I say it so many times, but for me, it's just about building culture. And it feels like we've lost small venues generally because of the financial situation that we're in. Like DJ fees have gone up because they can sell tickets. It costs so much to put on parties. Clubs have to get bigger. Costs have got more expensive generally. And I feel like there's a lack of culture building when things are so big. And I think a small 250, 300 cap venue is the perfect way to build culture and kind of nurture new artists into the scene.
Yeah, it's something I was really excited for when the project was presented to us. There's, like I said, there's something to be said with the 600 person rooms. You kind of catch them while the artists, while they're getting hot. Yeah. And here it really is like a labor of love. We like to say we're not, you know, just electronic dance enthusiasts, we're music people. And we really want to continue finding ways to push music at its core in any which way possible. So being able to have this space where we can be more experimental and we can kind of harvest more talent in that low stakes environment, it's something that we're all really looking forward to do. And our talent department is just absolutely incredible. And ownership, Kobe, is just has such a great ear for music, and Mark Andrzejczyk, shout out to them, because they just really understand where the market is going, but also who the new up and comers are that I even have to do my research on nine out of 10 times. I'm getting to that age where I'm starting to listen, recycle my music as opposed to find new things. Someone told me people stop listening to new music after the age of 26. And I'm starting to find that maybe true. I didn't want to believe it, but
yeah,
but that being said, that being said, we just have such an incredible team that it just made sense for how much when we love what we do, that we can continue pushing the boundaries of what we do.
Yeah, I agree. Kobe and Mark do a great job at booking the venues and the shows that you guys do. And also the thing that I really like what you guys do at Framework is you make really interesting shows. It's not kind of like cut out kind of you're creating experiences for people that they aren't experiencing before, and I think that's so important in an industry where it's so easy to just kind of do a cardboard cutout of here's a club, here's a DJ, and buy some tickets and come and have a great night. Like, with what you do with sound, changing the DJ booth up, keeping it fresh so that it's a new experience for people. All the outside events that you guys do, is they always look amazing. And I just
Thank
think it's
you.
It's just really, it's really important for me, especially for the culture of electronic music in America, where electronic music in America isn't necessarily looked at as, like, although it's started in America, it's not necessarily looked at as like the forefront of it. And I think what you guys do is really special. So yeah, it's really nice to see you kind of opening new venues and stuff. But I want to get into more of your job, because the reason why I wanted to get you on is because I love having people on here that are like more behind the scenes than the upfront artist, and kind of give people the perspective of, like, you can also work in the music industry if you're not an artist. In a sense, if you're not wanting to be the DJ or the producer or anything, I don't know if you want to be a DJ or producer or whatever. If you do, then crack on. But I think for me is like just giving people the opportunity of, like, that there are other options out there. So how the hell do you market? Like, where do you even start? Like,
I ask myself that question every day because it's constantly evolving.
Yeah.
I mean, it really depends on the nature of the event and what, you know, what brand in particular you're working with, because marketing isn't this one size fits all post to Instagram hopes the show sells. I think one of the most interesting things someone ever told me was being a good marketer doesn't mean just throw a show up that you know is going to sell because you know it's going to sell out. Like, yeah. Let's use Kind Music New York, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You know it's going to sell out. It has the Mirage factor. It has the Kind Music factor. It doesn't take a good marketer to do that.
Yeah.
What a good marketer is someone who can sell out a show or a club or maintain longevity in a brand where you have to educate audiences on why it is that this, you know, this show or this artist is worthwhile. So my approach has always been, what can we do to educate our audiences on either the artists that we work with or the venues that we're debuting to the market, or, you know, the new experiences that we're providing for people.
Yeah.
But also in a way that's not salesy, because we're constantly plugged in. We're getting ads served left and right. The consumer is so exhausted of getting sold to. So what approaches can you take that are engaging for our audiences, that provide value to them, but also in turn have some ROI for either the brand or the artist or the club? It all kind of stems from, okay, what's the goal here, right? So you book an artist, let's say for sound, for an example, say you book an artist at Sound, Night Freak, or let's use Francis Mercier. He's a great example because we booked him in LA in the first show. It was not necessarily an underplay. It was the right size room. He blew out the club completely, sold out. But it took time. It took the last second for us to get it there. Now he's not a brand new artist. I've been following Francis since I was probably 16 years old. He's from the New York scene. From New York, deep roots. Understanding, okay, so he has longevity in the scene. He hasn't necessarily played LA too often. His sound is really hot in LA right now. His music is some tracks that people can very easily recognize. How do we piece together this story and serve it to our audiences that they can put two and two together that, oh, Francis Mercier is playing that Premier Goo sound that is my favorite song, but I didn't know that was Francis. I think people who are not necessarily diehards of electronic dance music will be able to recognize a song that they really like, but they won't be able to say who played it.
100%.
So how do we make that connection, right? And that's a big focus of what we do, is how do we put A and B together so the consumer themselves can, you know, piece together why it's worth their time. And then Francis comes back the next time and blows out the club completely. Yeah. You know.
So going back to that initial one, so educating the crowd that this person is this person, right? Or this music is this person. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
How do you do that? The first thing that you look at is the first thing I look at is their Spotify. What is their highest stream track?
Yeah.
Before, up until recently, we were doing these things called artist cards, where we would feature their most streamed track or their most recognizable track, but also below list the artists that are most relative to them. So for Francis, it would be Kind Music, it would be Black Coffee, it would be Themba. So similar artists that may be 1 degree left or right of where they sit, but that fall in a similar vein that can help the consumer make the connection that, oh, I like Kind Music, oh, I'm going to like Francis.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I like Themba, I'm going to like Black Coffee, or vice versa. So piecing a puzzle together of how can we understand what you like and show you that we know what you like, but offer you a suggestion to continue your musical discovery journey. So a lot of digging for content of, you know, they say raw footage always performs best, and you're seeing it more than ever. A year ago, we would ask certain artists, hey, send us a video, send us a high quality video, and no one would have any. And in the last year, everyone has any because people are understanding the importance. Yeah. I feel like artists and management are now understanding how important that visual content is, particularly for, you know, promoters, brands, nightclubs, whoever it may be, to utilize that content to continue pushing that brand in a different market, or that artist in a different market. So it all kind of starts with really understanding who is the artist that you're selling. Because 9 out of 10 times like I said, I'm an old dog. I'm starting to understand
you,
that you can't
old.
Teach an old dog new tricks. I'm getting there. But you know, there's these new people coming up to be that, you know, I know my Martinez brothers, I know my, you know, my Marcus Wyatt's, the ones that have had longevity in the scene, but you know, the younger kids that are coming in, like Sammy Virgie, the first time he played sound, he just sold out the club on Thursday. The first time he played sound, I had no idea who he was, but there was so much heat behind it. Right. So
I'll be honest. I literally just found out who he was today.
Yeah. It's incredible what, you know, this new generation of artists who are understanding the digital scapes, you know, landscape and how to push their brands forward online, how that's translating, but also something to be said for that UK sound, which is so hot right now.
Yeah.
I think it's so fun. I think, you know, I'm really looking forward to Thursday, but it really is a good indicament of like these new up and coming artists that really are setting the tone for, you know, one, how they use social media, two, how we can leverage, you know, what track is hot to speak to our audiences, and three, like how, you know, where that goes in the future for them, you know, whether that's another sound play or whether that's a larger play. When you blow out a club once, if you look at Mochak, who did his LA debut with us, he blew it out. And then the next thing you know, he was playing Coachella. He was playing the Shrine Outdoors with us in Golden Voice, playing with the Martinez brothers at the Torch. So is seeing it is so cool to me because I also use it as like a music discovery tool. I don't often know the artists that we book, especially at sound, but getting to know them through the marketing process is also like personally really exciting for me.
Okay, so next step into marketing, you've created the relationship between the ticket seller or the ticket buyer and the artist. What's next?
I think marketing is a 360 experience. It's not just what happens to sell you the ticket. It's also what happens inside the club, from an operational perspective, from a, you know, engineering, lighting, sound perspective, environment perspective. So once, you know, the show does what it does, the tickets are sold, doors open, it really is passed off to the operations, the talent, and the lighting designer, the, you know, sound designer, and ensuring that we promise to give you a worthwhile experience.
Yeah.
Now you're going to come and you're going to get the full 360 experience. because you can go and see an artist that you really like, but have an awful time at the venue or an awful time at the club, wherever it may be. But if you're able to really cement that 360 experience being above a consumer's expectations every time, then that really is the biggest brand building aspect for a nightclub or for a brand. Like I said, with Framework, we do the large artists, for example, Chris Lake and Fisher at Hollywood Boulevard, you know, that's going to sell out, right? My job is easy in that regard.
Yeah.
I can communicate to you how to get to the venue, what we can offer you at the venue, ensure that our marketing communications make it as easy as possible for you to get from point A to point B to leaving and getting home safely. But the experience in itself is operations and, you know, production perspective. Now, after the event, it really is, again, goes back to content. Make sure you get the raw clips, the photos, the videos, and pushing that forward to really create that FOMO moment of, okay, wow, they did Afterlife and that was grand. Wow, they did Hollywood Boulevard. That was insane. So making sure that the content also speaks to the experience and the quality of that experience. Like I said, marketing isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. So what we do with Framework is not necessarily what we do with Sound.
Yeah.
Something that we've incorporated recently with Sound to kind of continue giving consumers something to come back for that isn't necessarily just selling them tickets, but is our recording our sets from Sound and putting them on SoundCloud while also asking artists to curate some Spotify playlists. So continuing to offer the audiences something that they can go home with or something that they can refer to at home that's provided by Sound or the brand, where they know that every week we will release a new set or every week we'll release a new playlist or a fun Q&A that will give them something engaging and fun as opposed to, hey, buy another ticket, let us take more of your money.
Yeah.
I think establishing that relationship where it's not a let us take from you and all you get is a fun night out at the club is as equally important as, you know, just getting people through the door.
Which I think is really important for brand building as a venue, as promoters, but also as part of the community. It's not necessarily just sell, sell, sell. And I think it's like that with artists as well, especially with social media nowadays, is that people want to get to know you as an artist. People want to kind of know a little bit more about who you are and a day-to-day living of who you are and what value can you add to somebody. And also, I think that really also helps the ticket sales, is how you interact with your fans. Obviously, on the massive shows, it's kind of slightly different. But I think I'd like to get your opinion on, like, the smaller shows, like, not saying sound small, but, like, with the artist, do you notice a difference with artists that have engagement on their social media in comparison to ticket sales to artists that aren't fussed about social media or anything like that?
I absolutely do. I mean, I think the perfect case study of this is Mochak.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say kind of came out of nowhere. No one ever comes out of nowhere. Yeah. That's just a myth. But to the public eye, kind of came out of nowhere with these incredibly filmed TikToks. But the TikToks aren't just raw footage. They're also showcasing his personality. Now, I'm sure you've met Pedro. He is one of the nicest people in the world. And the way that he communicates with his fans and online just showcases so much of that personality. And I think what we're seeing now with him, with Clooney, with artists who are very engaged, with you too, with artists who are very engaged with their fans, is the fans are so receptive to that. They feel like almost as if they have a personal connection.
Yeah.
You know, you see John Summit tweeting to his fans. You see it's a common thing now, and it establishes this psychological connection to the artist as if they're in a way your friend or reliable source. As opposed to the artists that take a little bit more of a backseat approach, there's definitely artists who, you know, can tap into that mystery, allure, that cool kid persona, and it works for them. But I think if you look at you know, the new rise of new club goers or new dance music enthusiasts. They're all younger. They're not necessarily looking to go out to be seen. They're looking to go out to connect, whether that's with the artist, whether that's with the community that's also going to the club, whether that's with, you know, the friends that they've chosen to go out with for the night. And I think that all starts with, you know, the ringleader, who is the artist, and how they communicate with their brands, especially those artists who, you know, enjoy that open line of communication. You also find that they bring an audience that also wants to interact with the people around them. Yeah. You know, they're more inclined to make a friend with the person dancing next to them, or, you know, community build in that way, which wasn't necessarily, you know, such a thing, an accessible thing before the age of social media.
Totally.
But you also see that tie between, you know, age and social media usage, and how different people in certain demographics are using social media for what kinds of purposes. Mm.
Is there a level where you find social media a negative when it comes to an artist's career and also selling shows?
You know, it's a really difficult question. I think in a way, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the negative of being so over inundated with options and feeling burnout and feeling FOMO and, you know, feeling like you can't necessarily hit them all, as a consumer, it definitely makes it difficult on the promoter end when, you know, now, like 5 years ago, I didn't really know what was happening in Tulum. I didn't really know what was happening here. I didn't know what was happening in Berlin. I knew what was happening in my market, and through word of mouth, I knew what was kind of happening in, let's say, LA or Miami. But now it's just so in your face that it's kind of hard not to experience FOMO, I think, for the consumer. On an artist side, it also makes it more difficult to break through the noise, especially with the rise of deep tech minimal and, you know, Technopie and all these, you know, Instagram accounts that, you know, used to be very organic, but now you can purchase placement. So you have mid-tier artists purchasing placements for their raw videos to kind of, you know, get their name into the consumer's minds from their live shows. But now you're seeing so much of it, and it's constantly rotating, that it makes it harder for certain things to stick. So on the artist side of things, it's almost like, what are we doing that's different, as opposed to just posting a video of me dropping a track at a drop, or a video of me prepping for a show. That oversaturation of the digital platform space is going to be dangerous, and it is going to eventually exhaust the consumer. What I do think is really cool, though, is discovery now is easier than ever for the people who want to, in what I like to say, digitally crate dig, whether that's through Spotify, whether that's through TikTok, whether that's through Instagram, and going through all of these channels of crate digging for new artists or new experiences in a way that wasn't necessarily accessible before. And that, I think, is a benefit, but also comes at a cost of having to break through the noise.
It's really hard. I totally agree with you. And I think it's something that I think everybody talks about, and it's that how do you break through the noise, right? And I think it's also what noise are you trying to break through, and what noise are you comparing what noise are you comparing yourself to, right? Because it's very easy to as an artist, right? And I'm sure as a club, as a venue, it's all relative, right? Who else are you comparing yourself to, and are you comparing yourself to? Obviously, it's very unhealthy to compare yourself to somebody. However, like, let's say, for instance, with me, I can only speak about myself, but if I was to compare myself to John Summit, well, that's just fucking stupid, because like, we're completely different artists. And but I think there's like a I think what happens, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, is the industry sees what's popping off at this moment in time and expects everybody to do the same. and everyone to be as successful as that. And for me, it's kind of like, actually, no, like you as a creator, you as a content creator, whether that's me as an artist or whether that's you guys as a club, you have to know your audience. So it's like, learn the audience, learn your audience, and then give them what they want or what you think they want. And you have to test, you have to work out.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
I think you hit it on the money. They say that imitation is the highest form of flattery.
Yeah.
And I think in some cases, obviously when you're starting to be, it almost helps to look at certain things as a case study of, okay, what are they doing that's working? But at some point you have to understand, again, marketing is not a one size fits all thing. Yeah. Is understanding who are you at your core? You know, like some people may not be fashion people. Some people may not, you know, feel comfortable talking to a camera. Some people may feel a little bit more introverted and don't necessarily want to engage, but want to connect. So what are they doing to connect?
Yeah.
It's really about understanding what works best for you also. For sound, last year, we were just realizing that we were spending so much time announcing shows.
Yeah.
Because we have shows every weekend. We have Sound Presents, which is our offsite brand. And it felt like all of our feed was just like constant announcements.
Yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, when do we have time for more meaningful promo? Like, when are we ever going to put out content that people actually want to see? Sure, people want to see announcements, but that's not really going to do much for engagement or brand building or, you know, getting trust. So I had pitched originally to consolidate all of our announcements to one day, which was unheard of for a lot of reasons. One being, no artist manager or agent wants to see the shine off of one, an individual artist announcement now booked into an announcement of 10 people.
Yeah.
It also goes to say of like, okay, like if we're not front and center, how do we actually get the word out about the thing? So I pushed really hard for us to do this. And I finally got everyone on board, and we've been practicing announcements on Wednesdays for, I think, almost a year now. And no one argues, no one pushes back now, because they understand, yes, you may be booked in with a couple of other artists, but now we have 4 or 5 more days in our schedule to actually do something more meaningful that the audience wants to see. That'll not just push the show, but that will push your artist forward more than just a flyer for an event. So looking at the problems that you're encountering on a digital scale, but also, you know, in a marketing scale, and not having to conform to what the industry or what the market is so attuned to, just because that's the right thing to do. Is if there's a problem, there's always a solution. And when there's a solution, you might as well try it out. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work out. And if it does work, then you've only, you know, created something new for people to offer, or a new path for people to kind of follow suit, that I think in a way benefits everybody in the long run. So that's kind of just a real life example of, understanding that not everything everyone does, it has to be the only way to do things online, that you can find ways that fit for your brand or fit for your voice or fit for the way that you want to interact or engage with people, not just as a brand, but also as an artist.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there was a huge thing a few years ago where promoters would want you to post the flyer on your social media. And I think it's one thing where artists just push back and realized, actually, I think promoters have now realized that actually that artists know their fans better and know that their content will do better if they do a video or if they do something else or if they do what works for that artist. We still get it today.
I will admit, I was absolutely one of those marketers that would get so, maybe not so much on the sound shows, but the framework shows, I would get so butthurt when the artists wouldn't support the show on their feeds. But especially over the last year, with how important digital has gotten and how online personalities and how people use or artists are using their social media, we've really come to understand that sometimes posting a flyer to the feed is the least effective thing that you could possibly do. You know, people are starting to understand how, what they can expect from an artist online, you know, how they communicate if they go live, if there's a Q&A, whether they're streaming, whether they'll drop a live set. Yeah. And I think that being able to understand these trends as a promoter and what you can expect from an artist, you have to be amenable to that. But I do always, I always hope for a story post now. It may not be a feed post, but give me a story post and I feel like we've won.
Yeah, it's really interesting though, because also like, how long have you been at Sound and Framework?
2 years in December, so a little over 2 years.
So you came in after the pandemic. And
yes.
So pre-pandemic, marketing shows was very different.
Yeah.
And
I was with Electric Zoo before.
You're allowed to say that name?
Before it all went down. Am I allowed to say that name? No, I totally understand. Before Sound and Framework, I was working at a marketing agency run by Michael Julian, who you also had on your show.
I saw. I'm Jay. I didn't know you worked with him.
Yeah. I worked with him. I was a marketing coordinator, turned marketing manager with him and Joey Zutera. That was my first marketing job. And I learned so much from them. I really, truly did. Yeah, I learned, honestly, they gave me the foundation, especially Joey, who I worked hand in hand with every single day, gave me the foundation to what the skill sets that I have today.
Yeah.
But yeah, marketing a show was completely different. But it's also ever changing because of the digital landscape, you know.
Every day it's changing.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, it changes every day, and I think that's the thing, is like, for me as an artist, I've noticed the change in 3 years of how a show sells, just generally, like how the ticket, the way people sell tickets, the way people buy tickets, it's changed massively, and it's constantly changing. How much do you rely on the community of like promoters in the community?
Not at all.
I like that.
Sound used to be, from my understanding and from what was told to me, very promoter driven.
Yeah.
We've honestly, as of this year, are not working with too many, if any at all, that are only activated on a very much need basis. Yeah. We are very active in the digital space, and solely rely on that and our organic communication.
Yeah.
Our open rates at Sound, our email open rates are around 50%, wow, which is almost unheard of.
How?
So, you know, it took a lot of building. I came on and they were in the 14%. And then data is so important. Everyone knows it. Data is the most important tool that you have. But understanding how you're using your data and not overwhelming your data with too much is similarly as important. So I spend a lot of time trying to understand, okay, how much communication is too much communication? What is the most important communication that I need to send you? And how do I break down these groups of people when I, you know, have an instance where I need to communicate a show in a very specific genre, but not overwhelm the entire audience? So we do our best to only communicate to the people that want to be communicated to. One, we have a loyalty list, and you know, they've opted in to receive more comms via text message, and that includes announcements, let's say promos, comp tickets, stuff like that. And then to our whole database, we really only hit once, maybe twice a week. And it is just a list of all of our upcoming events. And I think understanding that not just because you have the data doesn't mean you have to use it all the time, 100%. You know, and people are more inclined to open something that they know will give them value, as opposed to clickbaity emails that are trying to sell you something that you don't necessarily want. We do a lot of hyper-targeted organic marketing too, of like looking at, you know, similar genres of ticket buyers, right? If you like Afro House, we have you segmented. If you like techno, we have you segmented. Yeah. If you like classic house, we have you segmented. If you like going out on a Tuesday, I have you segmented. I know so much about our consumers. So when I know that there's an opportunity that I like to look at it, how would I want to be marketed to?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people ask me, I've never been to Ultra. I've never been to EDC. I've never gone to Ibiza. I lived in Miami for 6 months. I went to space once. I've never gone to Burning Man. I hardly listen to electronic dance music anymore. I'm so far removed from it. And someone asked me, how do you know what to do then?
Yeah.
You know, and I think being able to remove myself of like studying what everyone else is doing, whereas that's important all the time, staying attuned with like my toe dipped in the water, but also keeping myself separate from that and looking at it as, okay, if I wanted to be marketed this show, if I wanted to go to the show, what kind of content do I want from this brand? What kind of information do I want from this brand? How often do I want to hear from this brand, right? Because we, behind the scenes, we're also consumers.
Yeah.
I may not be buying a ticket to a electronic dance show or a festival, but I'll buy a ticket to Black Eyed Peas, the Black Keys or the Black Eyed Peas. I don't know anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Usher, whoever, right? How would I want to receive my communication from them? And how can I translate that to how we give information to our audiences?
I think that's really important as well, because you're not necessarily a consumer as of much as of, say, if you know what I mean, as maybe even what some of the customers that you guys deal with on a weekend basis are. I think it's really important to kind of, this sounds really condescending and it's not, so don't be offended, but it's almost like treat like how to market to like the lowest spectrum of electronic music listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a horrible way, but I think that there's levels of people. Like, let's just use me for example. There's certain people that engage with me on my social level that I announce a show in LA. There's a certain amount of tickets that we're worth to sell, right? From straight away. Mm-hmm. And that's purely just from my socials and from Sound socials and Sound's marketing. But then there's a layer below that probably are fans that aren't fully aware of that I'm on. And there's also a layer below that of people that have never even heard of me, that may have heard one of my records, but don't know who I am. And I think it's a really interesting way. And I think a lot of people don't look at it in that way on how to kind of just promote anything. It's like, these people, the time you're taking out of these people's lives is so important. Time is valuable to all of us. And I think we can't be arrogant enough to think that our time, us taking their time, is important to them. And we can't expect to take that time. What value are we giving to them?
Mm-hmm. There's nothing I hate more than getting random text messages from promoters that I've never opted into. It makes me almost not want to go to any of their events. I'm somehow opted into so many from New York that I don't even remember buying a ticket or opting in anywhere. Yeah. And it's so distasteful to me.
Yeah.
Of, okay, like, your phone is like almost the most intimate possession that we have, right? And if you're going as far to feeling that you have the right to text message anyone that you want, that you may have acquired 10 years ago through a promoter list, to me, that's just not good practice.
Yeah.
Being delicate and understanding that, you know, not everyone will look at it this way, because at the end of the day, we live in a capitalist society and making money is important. But the difference, I think, between a brand that cares about their fans in a 360 experience, not just in how much they're communicating to them or invading their personal boundaries by maybe text messaging them once a week or once a month, versus a brand that is just shoving things down your throat because they don't know what else to do, really speaks to over time brand trust building and being more of a reliable source, as opposed to we're desperate. Let me just text anyone whose phone number I've acquired in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's super important. Do you enjoy it?
My job?
Yeah.
I do. I feel very fortunate that I get to do what I do every day. I don't think anyone really knows how much sacrifice goes into being someone behind the scenes or even in front of the scenes. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that going into it. I'm a workaholic by nature, so it just kind of came naturally to me. But being an outsider looking in, a lot of people glamorize this industry of, oh, it's always traveling and partying and eating out and meeting the DJs and hanging out backstage and having the access. But it really, that's such a small minority of this industry, but it's so pushed in your face, obviously, because of social media.
Yeah.
No, and, you know, a lot of people make a lot of sacrifices that most, you know, most consumers don't know. You know, you have your event production people who are spending 3 days a week on site trying to build the event for you. You have show after show, so you can't necessarily go, like, sound is running every weekend, then we go into Coachella season, then we go into our off-site season. Yeah. So it's, there's something after something, there's always something on the books. So, you know, I don't get to go home often. My social life is definitely, it's, I have an amazing set of friends who are so supportive in what I do and understand, but there's periods of times where I'm just so overwhelmed with what we have going on in a good way, not in a bad way, but in like a, this is a child. My job is a child that needs all my attention all the time. And when I go home, I don't even have any energy for myself left of like, you know, understanding that dating is not easy. You know, having a social life is not easy. Taking time away is not easy. I don't get to see my family often. My best friend just had a baby in Alaska and I didn't get to be there because I just can't find the time to leave my job that fits in with her schedule and fits in with my schedule. So all of these personal sacrifices that we make are really hard, but I don't think anyone would be willing to make them if we didn't really love what we do at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Being able to see something come from booking the show to announcing the show to being at the show to the recap videos that everyone else forgets about, but I rewatch them all the time. I have every single one saved. I watch them back, especially when I'm feeling stressed or tired, to just kind of remind myself, like, this is what we do. We do this for the culture. We do this for the people and the community and these experiences that people get to carry with them for a lifetime. I can only be so lucky to be a part of that. So it's definitely, I love my job, but it gets difficult sometimes. And I think a lot of people neglect that it's not always partying glamorous.
Totally. I love that. I think that's the most perfect way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Will.
How can people get involved with what you do? How can people get involved with Sound Framework, Spotlight, all of that?
Yeah, follow us on socials. Follow us on socials. We're constantly putting out content. It's at Sound_nightclub on Instagram, at This Is Framework on Instagram. We're actually announcing a bunch of really amazing shows in the forthcoming weeks. I believe this is coming out in April, so by then they will be announced, but they will not have yet happened. So all really exciting things. I'm really excited to see you at Coachella. We can run around and cause some mayhem.
I think
there.
This is actually going to be out after Coachella. So I think.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I have to do like a backlog of podcasts because I'm in LA the whole of April. So I can't record when I'm out.
I love that.
So yeah, let's catch up. Well, by the time this is out.
Yeah, let's definitely catch up.
By the time this is out, we've played Coachella and we've hung out, so it's all good. Thanks.
Will has crushed Coachella.
hopefully.
Oh, there's my dog.
Oh, there's the dog. Mate.
That's the cute dog. Thank you so much. Will.
Keep safe. See you soon. Take care.
Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.